Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
Episode 271 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Babadooby, babadooby.
Indeed, sir.
Indeed. Well said, sir.
We are apparently finding our groove to, we discussed, of course, doing movie episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And how they're just going to kind of take over. But I feel like we're finding a weird groove of every other episode is a movie episode for right now.
I think that seems to be the deal for the moment, yep.
For the moment, because last week wasn't one, and next week won't be one. We'll kind of preview what that'll be later. But for today, we are going to, as threatened, I feel like that's the appropriate term, discuss Scorsese's After Hours.
Which I have, from many sources heard, is your all-time favorite film.
No. And not that I dislike it, but no.
Sorry. All right, let's get a kick out of the response that I knew you would have.
Yeah, well, I've seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't my first time seeing it, but I haven't seen it since like the 90s, and it didn't stick at all. Do you want to give a rundown on this one?
Sure. Well, this is 1985, Martin Scorsese. This was produced after the studio, I think Paramount, had canceled The Last Temptation of Christ, and
yes.
Scorsese was sort of kicking around for something to do, something kind of, I think he wanted to do something sort of guerrilla style, something sort of loose and fast. Found the script by Joseph Minion, which I believe was actually sent to him by Griffin Dunne and Dunne's partner. And
yes.
Is the rest history? The rest is history. Yes. So
the rest is history.
So After Hours takes place in over the course of one night in Soho, in which word processor Griffin Dunne, Paul Hackett. That's kind of an on-the-nose name, Hackett. I mean, this is kind of an on-the-nose movie in many ways.
Exactly. Like, it doesn't bother,
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So he's got this dull office job in which everything is beige, including his suit, all his furniture. But he's kind of a closeted romantic. Like, you could see if he goes out, reads Tropic of Cancer. He says dreams of something bigger.
We're going to discuss Paul a bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
I
have some issues.
Or at least he's kind of like one of these prototypical office job people who sort of has this inflated notion of the secret notion of themselves as possibly somebody more interesting than they are. Right. So he goes out, he's reading Tropic of Cancer, and runs into a girl named Marcy, played by Rosanna Arquette. They have a sort of quick exchange, and then he calls her, or rather he calls, under a pretense, he sort of gets in touch with her, goes to see her, and when he goes to see her, everything starts going wrong, loses his money, can't pay the cab fare, and the night just becomes a series of escalating nonsense and horrors until he finds himself, after this bizarre night, back in his office the next morning. So that's
kind of.
Yes. So that's the sort of 30-second summary of After Hours.
Yeah. And of course it has a huge weird cast.
It does. And that's probably one of my favorite things about the film. I love the cast in this.
Yeah.
Yep.
Terry Garr shows up, Cheech and Chong,
yes.
Linda Fiorentino, Rosanna Arquette, John Hurd.
Yep.
Catherine O'Hara. Brendan Pinchot. It's
yeah.
Now, what's really interesting to me is, of course, Griffin Dunne, used to have a much bigger career. As he's gotten older, he's done less.
Mm.
But I don't know that I've ever actually quite enjoyed him as much as I did in House of Lies.
Oh, that's right.
I feel like that was this weird sweet spot for him.
Mm-hmm.
Where he was allowed to be, because Griffin Dunn has, he has kind of like the voice and delivery of an 80s romantic lead and the face of a villain.
Yes. Yeah, you could picture him,
I mean,
like,
nothing against him. Again, he's a great actor, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, like you could picture him say, you know, like, what was that terrible 90s Hackers movie? I think it might have been Hackers.
Hackers?
Hackers, yes. the movie about the hackers, you know, they're on skateboards and roller skates.
Yeah.
But you've got like Fisher Stevens as like the sleazy villain. But I always thought actually, and I remember watching this thinking at one point I thought, was that Griffin Dunn? And no, it was Fisher Stevens. But that's the kind of role I always kind of picture him in, as kind of like a sleazy villain who sort of comes off as like this glad-handing, I'm one of the good guys, people.
Right.
I think that plays to advantage in After Hours in a weird way.
Oh, it totally does. But yeah. Again, like, you know, again, like in House of Lies, like that's exactly who he's playing, so it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Really strongly. In this, I would argue that he kind of is a villain.
He's
one of those people in the 80s who wants to convince himself that he's a good guy, but mm-hmm. also, let's be honest, all the madness starts because he meets some woman in a coffee shop, calls her. She's like, why don't you come over? He says, sure. Comes over, and then he starts hitting on who he thinks is her roommate the entire time.
Right. And yeah, no, he's not a good guy, but he believes he is.
Right.
He thinks he's Henry Miller, but he's simply not. And this whole thing is like a kind of a window or a gateway into like his fantasies about who he is.
Right. And what's interesting to me about this, And this is where I'm going to get into a theory that, like I said, I've never seen anyone say before out loud or in print. But one of the things I did find out, because, you know, again, when I first saw the film, like, 90s, I didn't know any of this. But that because this was right after that other movie had gotten canceled, that Scorsese has said that, like, a lot of kind of like the weird events and how he keeps trying and, right? And all this, mm-hmm. they're kind of what he felt himself.
That's
interesting because also you made him the bad guy.
Yes.
It's what are we trying to say?
That is, well, I remember one of the things I was reading in for background on this was that not only, I mean, Scorsese's career had kind of taken a dive at this point, which kind of surprises me to think that his career could take a dive, but apparently it had, you know, after sort of the success of, say, Raging Bull and stuff, you know, he alienated a lot of people with King of Comedy, and for good reason. I mean, it's a difficult alienating film. And then he just basically tanked on What's-His-Face, Last Temptation of Christ. And he had gotten sober. So apparently After Hours was the first film he made in a long time he was actually sober. So, I mean, there's, I think, a certain amount of, like, self-recrimination and flagellation in this. Yeah.
100%.
I'm assuming you caught the Scorsese cameo.
Yes.
Yes. But he's dressed, and I didn't notice this before, but he's dressed like, he's dressed like in a general's outfit. Like in that one shot where you see him in the punk club. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
And directing the light. So I'm like, that's a weird little touch, but
it's telling.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of those great weird, like, this is worth it to watch, regardless of all its weird flaws, frankly. If only because obviously Scorsese knows what the fuck he's doing with the film. But also just the fact that he is doing what should be a traditional farce as a black comedy, but making sure it's shot like a horror film.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a choice.
Yeah, it's a... There's a lot going on with that. And you can see that there's all kinds of other... It's one of these films where I think there's all kinds of other ways you can see it being done. Like, there's so many different styles that script could adapt itself to.
Right.
And Scorsese doing it like you say, a black comedy shot like a horror film, and almost like a Hitchcock horror film too. Like all these sort of close-ups.
Oh yeah, like the way
famous shot of the keys coming down.
Keys, right? Yeah, no, the keys was so Hitchcock.
Oh God, yes.
You know, the flashlights and the sound of the ice cream truck. Like all of it is just edging towards horror, but also never quite going there. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But never I'm going to say the thing now. You ready?
Say the thing.
The thing that like I said, it's never been said. You know what I realize this movie is?
Do tell.
This movie is Scorsese's, not literal, but Scorsese's attempt to do on film what Dahlgren did.
That is not something I would think anybody has ever said before in
I'm saying,
of the
but
universe.
This film is basically Dahlgren.
Wow.
Because if you look at what Dahlgren is, right, past mm-hmm. all the bullshit, all the weird academic theories of what Dahlgren is, which we all know are mostly wrong, Dahlgren is literally a book by an author that is essentially like all the boring bits that happen in between scenes in a novel.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's what Dahlgren is.
Yes.
Like, and, you know, and Kidd is just Delaney himself, which is why he sees Delaney in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
When Kidd looks in the mirror, he sees Delaney. Whenever anyone's character, any character's eyes go red in Dahlgren,
mm-hmm.
it's because their movements are suddenly being taken over by the author.
Oh,
and they are
yes.
going off to do a plot thing that you don't see. But that's the trick of Dahlgren, right? Like, it is all of the boring bits that happen to characters in between, which is why they're just like, wait, how did I get here? Why is it suddenly Thursday?
That's right.
Because they're just moved around by a god in this place that doesn't make sense because, you know, writers are often bad at writing geography in that sense. Like, all of it is just almost tongue-in-cheek, but it is the, here is the other side, like the underside of a novel. It's one of the reasons I love the book.
Yes.
Because that should be the worst book in the world, right?
Yes.
But again, like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, if you approach that concept, like here's two characters, it should be the dumbest thing ever if you just explain what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you experience it, you realize that, you know, that a master has been here and done a thing.
Right.
But the sort of, you know, dreamer, and again, so many people in their reviews are like, oh, it's dream logic, it's drug logic and all this, for the scenes in After Hours,
mm-hmm.
right, are all, if you remember that, this was Scorsese working out his own shit. So that Paul is essentially Scorsese.
Sure. Yep. No, I get that. He even looks a bit like Scorsese in the movie.
Right.
Yeah, like a universe.
Right. And he's going from bit to bit that are all interconnected in ways that make no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because they have to be. This starts looking like the underside of a movie. Where all of the scenes that Paul is coming in on and then fucking up are scenes in other movies that are more complete stories, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I really like that idea because he's just kind of glancing off of all kinds of other characters and just ends up sort of inexplicably in their apartments, like within their spaces. Yes.
Right, and that thing is like, it doesn't make sense. And again, like, locations kind of make sense, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like sometimes this bar is around the corner, then he goes to a diner that's obviously two or three blocks down. He leaves the diner, turns the corner, he's back at the bar.
Yes, yeah, the geography
and that's not
deliberate.
Right, and again, that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But it reinforces that Dahlgren connection to me. That, like, we're just watching kind of an author just sort of bounce off of scenes that might be for something, but there's not enough connective tissue, and the connective tissue is the director.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally. And so, again, it becomes Dahlgren.
I like that.
You know, it was released 11 years after Dahlgren. I don't know if I can actually picture Scorsese reading Dahlgren, though.
That seems like a bit of a... I mean, who knows? Who knows what's on Scorsese's bookshelves? But
again, I don't even think it was intentional. I'm just saying that it was very much just the same concept
mm-hmm.
in a twisted, bent way from each other.
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, I too have come up with a take that nobody has ever heard before.
Okay.
After Hours is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Interesting. Elaborate, please. I would like to hear this one.
I got nothing. It just I just thought of the word, and then my brain is desperately trying to like map the connections, but I can't. I'm so sorry.
I feel okay. Hold on. Yeah, no, I got nothing.
I'm just like, it's Catherine O'Hara. There we go.
No, it's just like later, 30 years later, Paul is still working in that place and was eventually killed in the Battle of New York. What do we got?
There you go. That's it. Or at the very...
I did find it fascinating that Scorsese's original ending was to leave him in that, like, plaster Paris and kill him.
Right. Apparently, Michael Powell said, you can't do that. Said you have to...
And which is why when you said, like, you find him back at his desk, and I said, kind of.
Kind of.
Because I noticed something, and then I had to go search to see if I just had... If it was, like, just a false thing, or if other people had noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently a lot of people have noticed it.
Yep.
That, you know, you see him... in his office and sit down, and then you start panning around the office.
Mm-hmm.
But after the first, like, two quick times that you leave, he's never at his desk again.
No, he's gone.
Right, which leads you to the, is he really there or not?
Exactly. Or maybe Thanos snapped him away. There you go.
Right.
There's our,
you know, maybe he just
connection.
Got up. Right. There doesn't have to be a conspiracy. It's just interesting given...
But it's,
originally he was going to die.
Exactly. I mean, it's obviously deliberate. Like, there's no other reason to pan around.
No, because it keeps coming back to and centering his desk.
Exactly. And showing it as an empty space.
Yeah.
But that kind of makes sense for Dunn's character. I mean, partly the sort of the tongue-in-cheek suggestion, or Scorsese having it both ways. Like, he survives, or does he? But also, right. It just works for Dunn, who is this film also just a complete sort of everyman. He's kind of a blank slate into which, you know, the filmmaker kind of pours a bunch of just circumstances and impulses.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually amazing how much of, like, low-key an asshole he is throughout the film. And but if you think about one of the things that always... struck me about this film is everybody he meets is kind of insane or seems kind of insane. But if you just switch it around from the other perspective of the characters he meets, he is like equally as nuts, if not more so.
Oh yeah.
He's like this bedraggled, like sort of desperate guy who shows up and then just begins to like snap and just like start shouting and then running away and then coming back and like, you know, pleading for them with him for like to no end.
It's you can, you know, obviously watch every scene two or three different ways and you get different characters out of it.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of the guy who runs the diner,
right,
who, you know, that schmuck. But yeah, I, you know, again, it's a fascinating, you know, early Scorsese thing. Well, mid-Scorsese thing, I suppose. And I, like I said, like, it's one of those movies that, like, I don't think I'll ever love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that I'm gonna, you know, like, I haven't seen it in about probably 30 years. I don't know that I'm gonna see it in the next 30 years.
Fair enough.
But it is also a fascinating movie to sit and watch.
It really
if
is.
If only for the weird tonal games he plays.
Yes, and I have to say, I mean, this was back in the mid, late 80s.
85 was when it was released, yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be the late 80s when I saw it, because I saw it on VHS. I mean, at the time, this was one of, like, my all-time favorite movies. But watching it again, like, without the same element of suspense, because, you know where it's going, I found it lost quite a bit. And particularly... Particularly, like, the entire first part of the movie I still really enjoyed. You know, everything to do with Kiki and Marcy. But I think as soon as he sort of comes back and finds Marcy, you know, dead, It seems right. like it got really absurd, but I found some of the, I don't know, some of the basic tension, like lots of things happening, but like the basic tension seemed to have drained out of the film, and it became more of a farce than a surreal sort of, you know, sort of journey into the darkness of the mind.
Kind yeah, of well, picture. I mean, there is a level where it is farce when he is near any character outside of Marcy and Kiki.
Oh, yeah.
But specifically around those characters, even early on, like, it's not farce.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I don't know. I think...
Like, what was that think... that drained the farce out of it? Or, I mean, besides the fact that he is a creep who really... It becomes very, very questionable very quickly in those scenes specifically, but not anywhere else in the movie, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's always a dick, but...
Yeah, I think it's the... Because that part of the film deals so explicitly with... explicitly with sexual desire. And
yeah.
Also, I think some of the presence of Rosanna Arquette, like, she seems like she has this screwball comedy performance, but there's something sort of so off-kilter and, like, not screwball, but sort of like you just don't know if this character is like unhinged or not.
Right. I kind of really deeply appreciate that Rosanna Arquette and Terry Garr give essentially the exact same performance.
Yes.
But like Terry Garr's is just, oh look, she's just kind of wacky and broken, and Rosanna Arquette's is she's hiding a knife.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And you know, and that's and I also have to say, just watching a film at a different time, like back in the late 80s when I saw this, her sort of absurd story of the sort of the 6 hour long sexual assault, and like the way the details keep on making it weirder and weirder as she with every sentence. Like when I watched that in the 80s, I was a teenager, I thought that was hilarious. I did not find it hilarious now. I was like, oh, yeah, this doesn't play well at all. You know. So
yeah, like I said, and because I had like really no memories of this movie, like I knew I had seen it, but it was, you know, 30 years ago.
Right.
It really was one of those, like, just where is this possibly going that is good for anyone involved? Yeah.
And I have to say, I love the whole sort of weird burn victim sort of thread that just kind of animates his like simultaneous like repulsion, but like desire, because he's like terrified of seeing these burn scars. Right. But at the same time, he really also kind of wants to see the burn scars. But I think one of the reasons he freaks out so much and leaves is because he cannot handle his own sort of desire to see something grotesque.
Yeah.
And that's why when he comes back, he sort of like takes off the, you know, the blanket to actually see the scars, and they're not there.
Yeah.
Jeez, I love that whole bit.
And of course, why at the end, besides, you know, between the burn scars and the sculpture in the early part of the film,
right?
He ends up in a sculpture, but not only because, you know, well, he ends up in a sculpture because of that, but also because he mentions like being in the burn ward, and you would see people in burn ward in like full body kind of cast and bandage like that.
Right.
Yeah, it's, you know, never have so many thematic parallels been placed all into one film.
To what end? Not always sure.
Right.
Like sometimes I honestly think with After Hours, some of the fun of the movie is that there are genuine things you can pull and threads you can follow, and some of it is just really there to like absolutely just fuck with you, and to say,
yeah,
oh,
I mean,
do you think this means something? Well, how about being chased by a Mr. Softy truck? What do you think that means, huh? You know, just on and on and on.
Right, and it's interesting that the last time we did a movie like this, we did an Altman film, because, you know, Altman would have not bothered trying to connect all the scenes.
No. Oh, I can imagine how Altman would have handled this. It would have been a really fascinating film. There would have been...
Right. It wouldn't have worked, but it would have been fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. would have been a real mess. Yeah.
But you see what I'm saying, right? Like, it's the same kind of disconnect, but he would have done it without some connective tissue to at least keep you going.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I kind of realized when I was like, okay, this is 85, is like Griffin done at that stage of, you know, things and all this? And I realized, like, had this movie been made 2 years later, it would have been Bruce Willis.
Oh, my God.
And that movie would have been so much worse for it. Nothing against, like, again, like, I like early Bruce Willis, like, you know, but this is not his movie.
No, Willis is more Jersey than Soho, if, I don't know. If,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he did the Blind Date movie, which is about as close as he'd ever come to this.
Oh, right. Wow. Yeah, I mean, he can play comedy, but this is a very particular flavor of comedy.
Exactly.
And what I also found interesting with this film is that it really, at the time, lined up with a lot of other films that I was enjoying at the time. Things like early, like, you know, Abel Ferrara's stuff, like all set in Manhattan, or like Desperately Seeking Susan, like Susan Seidelman films, which, you know, also took place in that same milieu and had some of the same actors, like not just like Rosanna Arquette, for example, but a lot like some of the background sort of like actors were the same sort of like sort of New York downtown art scene sort of people. Or is it uptown? I don't even know. But anyway, also that one diner, that looks so freaking familiar. I'm wondering if that's still...
I'm fairly sure that diner set had been used other places.
Okay.
What I did also find interesting, though, was it was 85. It was supposed to be set in 85, I guess.
Presumably, yeah.
But its version of Soho, and I mean, yes, at the time I was 10, but... Like, I was still going down to the village, and not at night, but you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't that far off.
Right.
Its version of Soho was, like, 5 to 10 years out of date.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know why.
I don't know.
I don't think it matters. But again, obviously, release date versus when it was made versus when it was written.
Right. So what would the Soho of 85 been like then?
It's things like the, you know, look at this, we're supposed to be, you know, kind of reacting to, like, the two, like, leather daddies at the bar making out. And it's like that, I mean, would still happen, I guess, but it wouldn't have been, I don't know, anything to notice.
Okay.
At that point. Things like that. You know, the neighborhood itself down there certainly did not, like, you know, get together to solve crime. Like, that's not a thing.
No, that didn't feel at all Manhattan-esque, I gotta say. But it was funny.
You know, like, in one building, sure, but, like, across all the buildings, no. That kind of club existed, God knows, but almost never that big. Or that well-kept, God knows. It's just things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The village was already quickly changing, and a lot of those clubs were moving different places. And again, it's not a big deal. It's just, yeah, it was also just a little weirdly sparsely populated. Like, that's the thing. It's like, so in, like, the 70s, it was a lot less populated than it was in the 80s.
Right, yeah, there's a bit of an emptiness to the streets, which that
certain
worked.
Parts, at yeah. certain times, yes, but, like, again... mid-70s, more than mid-80s. Right. And it's not, again, it doesn't matter. It just caught my eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, the look of the streets was, I mean, it felt like there were, you know, that's when it began, there's a point at which it began to kind of feel like a bit of like 1930s sort of like German expressionist stuff, just
right.
all like sort of like empty streets except for like, you know, the sort of Griffin Dunn running from the mob and sort of, you know, climbing up things. And
yeah.
So that was stuff. Also, I'm the guy that got shot. I almost want to go back to that moment when he sees a guy get shot in the window.
Because
it looked a little bit like Danny Aiello. I don't think it was, but it was. No, it just kind of caught my eye for a brief moment.
But yeah,
it probably wasn't.
I wonder if there's, like, a credit for, like, let me just, I'm just trolling through the credits really quick to see if...
Sure.
Let's see, could he be Dead Man?
Yeah, maybe. I think he's the only... I mean,
there's
the
someone
only...
credited as Dead Man. Yeah, that's the only one that would be close, because listed right after Woman with Gun.
Oh, yep, that's them.
So Victor Magnotta.
That is not Danny Aiello at all.
No, but Victor Magnotta was in The Warriors.
Huh.
And is mostly a... Yeah, he's... Like, After Hours was the last movie he was in. And mostly he does stunt coordinator stuff.
Oh, interesting.
I'm trying to find out... Oh, he died in 87, which is why... that would be why. It becomes
kind of ironic, don't you think, that he's a... No, it's not ironic at all. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So.
Oh, sorry. Just got a quick email.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a good movie. It just sure is a weird one.
Yeah. So
like,
even for
Scorsese films, right? Like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. It. I mean, people. Lots of people say, it's not like any other Scorsese film. To me, it feels very Scorsese-esque in many ways. But it is. Yes. It is an outlier in sort of how sort of like rough and ready it feels, and you know, and now it's like he doesn't do many comedies, like not even.
No.
And you can tell he likes his comedies dark. Considering, like, you know, King of Comedy, you know, which was...
Well, right, and again, like, you know, the next movie he did after this, mind you, was mm-hmm. Color of Money.
Ah, okay.
Which is probably my favorite Scorsese film there is.
It's a great sort of film, especially as, like, watching it with The Hustler. I mean, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. But you can also see, I mean, like, it's so obviously the same person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the same director between these two films. Like, there's no mistaking it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, it just, I don't know, I'm not sure. Like, yeah, like I say, when people say, this isn't Scorsese at all, I'm like, are you certain? It feels like you can tell that, like, you know, his editor, Thelma Schumacher, did this. I mean, it just feels so Scorsese-esque with the sort of the constant prickly nervousness, you know, and the tension throughout the film. I mean, that.
Yeah, but I do. I think the farce of it all is what throws a lot of people.
I think so. I think that's the thing that they don't expect from a Scorsese film.
Right. And yet again, like, you know, you go to Color of Money and there is a certain level of playfulness in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, not that Scorsese doesn't do fun, but there are certain ways he uses humor, not only just going like for black humor with it, but just ways that Scorsese specifically writes and directs humor
mm-hmm.
that feel very much like him, and they are very on display in this movie.
Yes, exactly. Now, you mentioned earlier that you said this movie, for all its flaws, and I'm curious what you think the flaws are in After Hours. You've talked around them, but I'm just wondering what...
Right.
Like, if you had to say what you did not like about this film.
I think the end is rushed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have him up to being chased, and he has no one to trust, and how is he going to get away from this and all this? And then he's going to end up as this, you know, piece of art. And then, oh, look, the thieves are going to happen to break into under a club that happens to have, like, a sewer grate above it. And they're going to somehow know that it's there and just grab him and also act like he weighs nothing when that is a full human body in Plaster of Paris.
Right, yeah.
And then he's just going to happen to fall, like... Yes, the coincidences are part of the entire film, so that's fine. But it is just all of a sudden we hit the and now we need to end this.
Yeah, that is quite true. Like they just ran out of stuff. And they were like, okay.
Right, and I feel like a lot of the film does that, though, is that if you notice that the... and I don't know if this is a flaw, but it's noticeably weird to me. The scenes, the situations, get smaller consistently throughout the film.
I definitely noticed that. I don't think that's a flaw. I think it's just... I understand that structure.
Right. No, I understand it is structure, but I think it ends up being a flaw when, because of that, the ending is just, and now this, and we're done.
Fair enough.
There was some level of just, again, just a number of people who were like, sure, come up to my apartment. Like, what? You know, and I'm here for the black comedy of it all, the farce of it all, but, again, there was that thing of, if you look at it through the Dahlgren lens, it makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. But if I look at it through any other weird lens, it just feels like we're going to do a thing that is supposed to be like vaguely realistic and kind of creepy, but also doesn't hold up under its own rules. I don't know. It's, you know, and there is some level of idiot ball going on.
I like that idea.
Well, I mean, you know the idiot ball thing, right?
I've never heard the term, but...
Oh, okay, you know, it's a term that started, I forget what it was. There was some sitcom where the main actor in the sitcom actually coined the term idiot ball when he would ask the writers, who's holding the idiot ball this week?
Oh, nice.
And the idea is that a lot of sitcoms, any episode is predicated on one character acting out of character in order to do something dumb to drive the plot.
Yep.
And they are considered to be holding the idiot ball. This movie had its moments of weird idiot ball. I just, and again, it's, and part of it is obviously like the stress of things and all this are affecting, you know, are affecting Paul, and that's sort of fine. But like once he hits the bar and he talks the bartender into, you know, well, I'll just go by your place and I'll get you this key. And then once you have the key, you'll give me the money for a subway fare, right?
Right.
First of all, idiot ball in that why does the bartender, who doesn't own the bar, have the key to the register? And without the key, he can't open the register, but he opened the bar that night.
I know.
How did he do that?
Who's to say?
But you see what I'm saying? Like, there's a level of idiot ball involved in that. That, like, it just, it doesn't, it's forced not in the, let's make this a farce category, but it's forced because, oh God, we need this, I want this thing to happen, but there's no way, not even in farce, to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Other than this one character making no sense. Because right. Again, he couldn't have opened the bar. Like, all the other weird idiot, all the other, like, weird circumstances, fine. But the idea, like, he just couldn't open the bar. It's like, what? And then here are my keys. Go get me the key to this place, which, of course, he never does bring back, that key.
Is it the key to the bar or just to the register, though?
No, it's the key to the register. That's what I'm saying. Right, it's like, yeah. But you can't open a bar
without having the register, yeah. See, I assume that the register...
You would have checked that.
Right, I assume that the register was working and then it jammed or locked somehow, so... But he would have had to unlock it in the first place. So yeah, right. it doesn't make a lick of sense.
And you know, the turn off this alarm, which also doesn't go off?
Yeah.
You know, bring me this key and sure, and then he, you know, like, the toilet floods, so he just kind of runs out of there. Noticeably, by the way, leaving the key to the register.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Also, and, strangely enough,
yeah.
How, like, it, so if I recall correctly, the bartender gives him his keys to his, gives him like his set of keys, but somehow right. manages to lock up the bar. So I guess they had like, he had like another set of keys for the bar as well.
Right, he had like his house keys, and then he had the bar's keys, but the bar's keys don't include the key to the register,
which he keeps at home. Yeah, for I know it is a bizarre detail.
And I mean, and it's on the one hand, it's a minor nitpicky thing. On the other hand, in a movie that is built on surrealism and to move from A to B, where a lot of the surrealism, even if it doesn't make sense, it at least hangs.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get to that bar, a lot of the surrealism stops hanging together.
Hmm.
You know, oh, this like club is, like, even at the end, this club is closed for a private party at the end of the night.
Right.
Except they're just giving out invitations randomly now.
Yes.
Which, fine. Fine. Who cares? But, you know, he gets in, like, oh, we're closing 15 minutes, which, okay, but he hadn't left there for like an hour, so what was this private party going to last? 30 minutes?
Yeah.
So, okay. But then the mob is like, we should, you know, the mob looking for, you know, looking for him and looking for the burglar is like, oh, we have to investigate this place too. Why? Were you breaking into every store that was closed?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it just, it breaks its own sense of self a few times.
Yeah.
In a way that, and again, if I look at it through the Dahlgren lens, it all works for me, strangely enough. Because that specific lens of just the, no, we're backstage at a thing. We're watching the improbable bits.
Right.
Makes sense. But it's just, I don't know. There is that level where it sets up its world and sets up its own internal rhythms. And they just slowly break down, but not in a, not along any of the same curves or patterns that everything else either breaks down or builds up, so it doesn't feel intentional.
Fair enough. So what I hear you saying is that you're a better filmmaker than Martin Scorsese.
Yes, that's exactly it. No, I mean, you get what I'm saying, though. Like, none of it is a deal breaker. None of it is, you know, oh, this movie is terrible. Like, when I say flaw,
yeah.
I mean, like, minor stuff.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Kind of,
it ruins the rhythm a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's there are weird things in it like that. I mean, even in amongst the sort of the surreal nature of the movie, if you sort of consider it for one moment, you're like, how would that actually work? And it just, yeah, so yeah,
right. And it's not that it necessarily matters, but it's just that when you can do it with everything else, it sticks out.
Right. And if I recall correctly, like that final scene, that last scene takes place at the Club Berlin, right?
Right.
But when he went to Club Berlin earlier, it was just this sort of manic, sort of punk place.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and when he goes back, it's this sort of like sleepy.
Well, because he goes back and it's suddenly in the private party.
Yes, yes.
But it wasn't in a private party when he first went, when right. It was Mohawk Night.
Right, right. Mohawk Night, yes. Yeah, exactly.
So, and I said, like, that's why that kind of annoyed me, because that literally would have been a private party that would have lasted an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's fine, if that's what you're doing, then why is there someone passing? It just, again, it stops hanging. And starts, I don't know, it just starts to kind of do a thing because it's doing a thing.
Right. Yeah, maybe just thinking, perhaps Scorsese, you know, and ended it on sort of rather strangely abruptly, because maybe sense that the film could wear out its welcome at that point. It was like,
maybe. I mean, and maybe it really was just simply that, you know, it was, if you consider an ending where he dies,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe it's just it gets shorter and shorter and shorter as we rush toward his death.
Yep.
I don't know.
Because it's obsessed. And I mean, I'd actually be kind of curious to see how long each scene actually is. Because my sense is that, like you say, that. With every scene we get to, it begins to sort of like constrict around him. I'm just wondering
yeah.
if it just becomes sort of like shorter and shorter, sort of more bizarre scenes. Also, we haven't really mentioned this, but the focus on clock faces and time is,
yeah.
I also found that as a way to structure a movie, it's kind of, it's weirdly like an obvious way to like show the passage of time, but also it's not something that's usually done. I think mostly because most films don't take place in such a compressed time frame.
Right.
But I sort of enjoyed the way, like it feels like he's he's always, the whole movie is constantly counting down towards dawn. And that's another thing, is that after Marcy dies, and he puts up on paper, dead person.
Oh, God. That was... That was like probably the grimmest thing in the film. Like that, honestly, I was just like, okay, I don't know that I'm rooting for this motherfucker at all anymore. That's it. We're done. Like he was questionable before with the whole Marcy stuff, but then that was just like, oh dear God, fuck you.
Yeah. And I love that he's like the one good thing he tries to do, which is still a little self-interested, is to like rescue that sculpture, which turns out to be the one thing that, you know, that Neil and Pepe actually have purchased it in their crime spree. Anyway, yeah, that was amusing. But yeah, him just sort of like taking off and then leaving like a comb in the door so the cops can get in or whatever, you know. Oh my God, or the paramedics, I don't know. That was...
Yeah, and then he goes back and not only have they been there, but they've taken down all the signs.
Yes. Yes, I know.
Like, that was such a weird, like, I actually love, like, that was such a perfectly surreal touch.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to just kind of go, like, wait, did the paramedics just, like, take down all the signs?
I know. Thanks for showing us to the dead person. But that is also another running sort of, like, visual gag in that movie, which fits in quite nicely with your Dahlgren idea. He'll turn around... Like, he'll do something, and then he'll turn around, and there'll be weird things added or removed from the scene. Like, when he goes to the bar, and he gets up to, like, use the phone or something. I can't remember. And it's, like, this one sort of fairly continuous shot. And he goes back, and there's the check, which says on the other side, which you think is going to be the waitress's phone number, but it's just, you know, I hate this job, help. Like, somebody who's, like, trapped, like... Sort of help, get me.
Well, and
here.
it was even weirder because it was actually help. I hate this job.
Right.
So you get the help first, and you're just like, whoa, where is this going?
And then I hate this job, which is
okay, you're just bored.
Yeah. And then later he actively tries to avoid her, but like when she's sitting at his table, then he goes to the bar and engages John Hurd's character in conversation. I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot of bits like that I really like.
Me too.
Yeah, and just this sort of enjoyable sense that everything is just oh so slightly out of his control at any moment because he can't trust that anything he sees is going to be there, like the moment he turns away, like it all just be sort of swept away and something more terrible, like, you know, in its place.
Can we also discuss the fact that again, like just like kind of. Roseanne Arquette and Terry Garr are kind of had the same performance.
Yeah, and a little bit with Catherine O'Hara's character, too.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Can we also mention, like, Catherine O'Hara kind of had that same thing, but hit the midpoint between them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, just that precise midpoint.
Yes. Yeah, just sort of... one of the things I wished in the film... was that we had gotten more Catherine O'Hara because she was just so good. Like, she's basically only in one scene when it comes down to it, but she just played it so just this prickly sort of, I don't know, just ready to turn on a moment's notice sort of figure.
Well, right, and then she ends up leading, like, the vigilante mob.
Yes.
And, like, giving them orders and everyone's just obeying it. I'm just like, what is happening? And again, like, this is where the movie shines, right? Like, is where that Dahlgren thing comes back into play, in that it makes... It's not that it makes sense, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
In kind of a metatextual way.
Yes.
That you know, all of his life is being ruined by his choices and how he is treating other people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It just pops up. Yeah, this is... Yeah, what a fun film. I don't know. I was really glad we watched it. Like you, I'm not sure if I do want to watch it again anytime soon, but but it felt very, I don't know. It also was. I watched it at a time in my life when I was really sort of kind of drowning myself in all kinds of films. So this is felt like a throwback to that time. For me. Also, I didn't see it on VHS, so
That was nice. Hey, bonus. Well, we can kind of stop there, end a little bit early. Mention that next week we are, I believe, taking a break from movies, and we'll be... I think we had agreed to discuss kind of two things that are the same thing. A, just Stranger Worlds in general, because the first season will have ended.
Yeah.
But also the different way that Star Trek treats nostalgia for itself than Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. I'm happy to talk about that.
Yeah, like, I already know that, like, I have some theories, you know, and some reasoning brewing, and I think it's an interesting discussion to have, because, well, it's an interesting discussion to have.
I agree.
But for now, we can play some music.
Play some music. Woo!
Woo!